Thanks, Lars. I should say thanks, boss, because he's our boss while we're here, and thanks, former boss, and thanks, board member who approved this program. I think you were on the board at the time. So, and thanks to the Star Formation people for coming, because you can then correct me when I make mistakes. So I wanted to, so the title I gave was Star Formation and the domestic anomalies of galaxies. So I wanted to start by justifying or at least explaining this title. The star formation part you kind of expect because it's part of this, you know, it's in the title of the program, so I'd better have it there. And similarly, galaxies, you kind of expect that from this kind of program. What's Economy doing here? So it may be because I've been reading about the financiers of the, from the time of the First World War up to the Second World War and how they really wrecked everything. So Economy is a little bit on my mind. But more generally, the word economy just means careful management of available material resources. And it comes from the Greek, the term oikonomia, if anyone knows Greek better than I do, which is household management. So the economy, when I talk about economies, it's really how a galaxy manages its resources. And so the domestic part. Well, the previous Blackboard talk that was given by Norm Murray, that I'm not sure any of you were here for that, I guess the Star Formation people, I haven't followed in detail the cycle of the programs. But when Norm Murray talked a month or so ago, he talked about the problems of galaxy formation, and in particular, this problem that galaxies have only a fraction of what you could think of as their cosmic complement of baryons. So at most, it's about what you see in the observed galaxy is only about a third of the cosmic complement of baryons compared to what the dark matter in the halo is. And so what Norm talked about was how some issues in galaxy formation, and in particular that you need winds in order to drive some baryons out of the galaxy so that you don't see them within the galaxy. So in the metaphor of economics, you could think of that as international economics, that the galaxy is trading baryons with its partners, and so that's international. That's the large-scale balance of trade. And what I'll be focusing on is domestic, that is, what happens within a galaxy. And so it's not the balance of trade between nations, but it's the trade within the nation. And that means, you could think of it at different scales within a nation. So in a nation or a state, you can think of what are revenues for taxes, what are expenditures on roads, schools, that kind of thing. Or on the scale of a company, you can think of, well, what do they, what is their capital and labor expenses, and what do they actually get in when they produce goods and services that they sell to the public? So one way or another, these entities have to balance their books. And the time scale that they balance their books does tend to depend on how big the entity is. So if you think about a nation or a state, they get tax revenues in maybe quarterly if they're lucky, but once a year. And then they have to balance their budget. Well, maybe they don't balance their budget, but they're sort of, on some very long time scale, they, on the order of years, they will be balancing their budget. On the other hand, a business has to make payroll every week, so they can't run a very long-term deficit. So the scale of a system will really, to some extent, set what the spatial scale, in some sense, will set the time scale that it needs to balance its books, its cosmic books or its galactic books. And for balancing the cosmic books, the time scale is more like a giga year, so 10 to the 9 years. If you think about how galaxies are balancing their books with respect to the universe. On the other hand, within a galaxy, the timescales are much shorter because you're thinking about, you know, a thin layer of a galactic disk, or you're thinking about an individual cloud. So there the timescales may be more like 10 million years or even shorter. So we think about different scales when we're thinking about, you know, how we have to balance the books, or when we have to, the timescale that we need to balance the books.
So I didn't understand. When you're talking about the internal timescale, you mentioned the thin disk. You're thinking of just worrying about balancing a local region in the thin direction, or you're thinking about the timescale for really, you know, stuff to go all across?
So when you're thinking about this timescale, which is more like 10 million years,
okay.
And the reason that's relevant is that the gas is not migrating, you know, over. That's essentially the shortest time scale that matters.
Sure.
It can move from the outer part of the galaxy into the inner part of the galaxy. That will take a billion years.
Mm-hmm.
That has to happen because you use up gas and it has to get resupplied. So that happens, but on a much longer time scale.
And you're not interested in that today?
Not today. Yep. Good. Thanks. Okay. So I guess the first question is, then, how do we even know that galaxies actually are in any kind of equilibrium? How do we know that they're balancing their books rather than in some extreme transient state? And one way we know this is that if you look at galaxies, they're not really changing that much over a timescale of billions of years. If you go back to high redshift, they look different. But over the last few billion years, they haven't changed that much in their characteristic morphology, the number of different galaxies. So they haven't really changed that much. And we can also historically infer properties such as the star formation rate by looking at chemical signatures to see how galaxies have enriched over time. And that says also that star formation rates averaged over sufficiently large scales are not changing dramatically over billion-year timescales. So let's at least take as a working assumption that galaxies are in some kind of approximate equilibrium. And then, which equilibrium? What matters for equilibrium? So what I should say next is a little bit about what a galaxy is, since some people, I hope, are here from the CITER and particle programs. And so if we think about the Milky Way, which is actually a fairly typical galaxy at the present time of the universe, I'll say a little bit about its basic properties. So on the large scale out here, that's the dark matter halo. And the total mass in the dark matter halo is about 10 to the 12 solar masses within the virial radius. And that virial radius is about 200 kiloparsecs. So that's the dark matter. Then there's a galaxy down in here. I don't have the scale quite right.
And
this is a disk seen sort of oblique. So I could draw it. If I drew it edge on, it would be really thin. So I could draw it.
The dark matter.
So sorry. The
is
spherical, basically spherical.
And how do you know that?
From clusters.
Yeah, from clusters, from lensing. So from lensing, you know, you can fit it. You can fit the potential. So there's at least the potential is basically spherical. Okay, so down in here is the galaxy, which is the disk is of order 20 parsecs, it's 20 kiloparsecs in radius, and the mass in stars is about 6 × 10^10 solar masses.
So people play a lot with the Van Matten distribution, and they think about cusps and so on.
Yeah, so there are issues about the cusp, the detail of the cusp, but that won't come into too much what we talk about, because there's an overall potential, and within the galaxy, where the gas lives, the dark matter is important for the rotation curve, but for if you ask about within this layer of gas, what's the most important for the potential, and the answer is stars. And if you go to some more extreme environments, what's important for the potential net is what determines the gravity attraction towards the midplane. It can be the gas, but it's generally not dark matter, except possibly if you go to the extreme outer parts of galaxies. So in what I'll talk about, which is where we live and where most of the gas lives in the galaxy, it's either the stars or the gas that is determining the essentially the gravitational potential. Although the dark matter is important for the orbital dynamics and in a sense for what keeps a disk being a disk. Okay, so that's the overall radius. The scale length is about 3 kiloparsecs. So it's an exponential disk with that scale length. Then the and so if you just look at the ratio, this mass, the baryon abundance is about a fifth of the dark matter, and then what you actually see in the galaxy is about a third of its complement of baryons. In both lower mass and higher mass galaxies, that fraction is actually smaller. Okay, so most of all of that I've drawn here, though, is kind of inert. That's true both for the dark matter, certainly, and also for most of the stars.
Excuse me, just for the sighter people in the room.
Yes.
What's a baryon?
Baryon is regular matter, so meaning protons, neutrons, electrons, as opposed to non. What did I say? Oh, I said electrons. Sorry, I didn't mean to say electrons. I meant things that have mass.
I didn't mean to raise any contrary.
Right, sorry. No, that was. I just went too far. So as opposed to the unknown dark matter. So talk to the particle people about that. Okay, so most of this, though, is inert. And from the point of view of, you know, what will be participating in this economy will be a small fraction of the stars and the interstellar gas. And so let's talk about those. And actually, should I say what a kiloparsec? A parsec is about 3 light years.
We're
so
probably good with
parsecs. Okay. All right, just checking. Right, so this is all mostly inert, and what's interesting from the point of view of the economy is the stars and the small fraction of the luminous stars and the interstellar gas. So the luminous stars are the O and B stars. The B stars have masses between about 2 and 16 solar masses, surface temperatures between 10,000 and 30,000 degrees. The O stars are the most massive there, from 16 on up to 100 or 120. It's not clear what the upper limit is. And surface temperatures from 30 to about 50,000 degrees. So these are they're both hotter, and they're also much more luminous. But the luminosity goes as something like the 3.5 power of the mass. So they're much more luminous than a star like the sun. And the quality of the radiation is also different. So these stars have a much stronger UV. And that matters because that can ionize the gas and also just, in general, interact more strongly with atoms which like UV as opposed to the infrared or optical, which kind of just goes right through gas. Although it does get absorbed by dust. And dust also plays an important role. Okay, so these are the stars that are important. A thing to keep in mind, though, is that only a small fraction of the stars are those important, interesting stars, because the distribution of stellar masses is dn dm goes as m to the minus 2.35 above about a solar mass, and then it turns over with a peak at a few tenths of a solar mass. So these are a small fraction of the total stars, although they do provide most of the luminosity. And a useful number to remember is that if we want to think about what's the cutoff for a high mass star and what's the fraction of the total mass, The total mass in stars per high mass star, where I've defined high mass star as one which will ultimately have a supernova, is about 100 solar masses. So that's how much mass there is. Per supernova. And there's a supernova if it's, if the mass is greater than 8 solar masses. So high mass stars have very short lives, between 3 million for the most massive stars, 30 million for the higher mass stars. So in a sense, we can think of the high mass stars as really tracing very recent star formation, because they're young, so they had to have been formed recently. And that means when we think about star formation, where it's intimately related to high mass stars. So the radiation field that is present in a galaxy will be essentially determined by the recent star formation rate, because the number of massive stars is proportional to the star formation rate. Therefore, the radiation that they produce is also proportional to the star formation rate. So we can say that the radiation field is proportional to, and what I've written here is the surface density of star formation. So solar masses per square parsec per year as typical units. Okay, so this radiation field is proportional to the surface density of star formation. And other forms of feedback, which is really what we're interested in this program, are also proportional to the star formation rate. So let's summarize what the different forms of feedback that might be relevant are, and what you can get from them. Okay, so there's radiation, which again is mostly from the more massive stars. And for young clusters that sample the distribution, sample the standard distribution of stars, the luminosity in ergs per second is about 2,000 times the mass of the cluster in grams. And these numbers are very similar if you use solar masses and solar luminosities. So that's for a cluster that fully samples the distribution of masses. You can also write this as the total luminosity in stars for a given, so this is steady state star formation. And if you have steady star formation, the total luminosity in stars is proportional to the star formation rate, because you get a certain fraction of the star's energy out over its lifetime. And that fraction is about 6 times 10 to the minus 4. So that's how much you get out of, you know, if you do it in units of the star's mass. That's what you get out of it over its lifetime. Okay. And you can also write down what, you know, how many ionizing photons you get per star as well. Okay, so most of the radiation that is produced by these stars actually doesn't get absorbed by the gas, because the gas isn't so good at absorbing radiation. And it mostly gets absorbed by dust, and then it's re-radiated and in the IR, and it's lost by the galaxy. So if you actually look at the fraction of the radiation energy that is absorbed, if you look at the ratio of the, say, the cooling in gas compared to the cooling in IR, that's a fraction of a percent, maybe a few tenths of a percent. So only a fraction of the energy actually goes through the gas. Most of it is absorbed by the dust and then re-radiated immediately. So that's one source of feedback is radiation. Another is supernovae. So for one supernova, you get 10 to the 51 ergs, and we need this mass, total mass of stars per high mass star. So that's, you can divide the star formation rate in the galaxy divide by 100 solar masses and multiply it by that energy, and that's the energy input rate from supernovae. And you can rewrite this similarly to the way that radiation is done, where now this is 6 times 10 to the minus 6. So much less energy is actually going into supernovae than is going into radiation. That's just 1%. So you might think that this is not important, but it's keep in mind that only a fraction of a percent of this energy actually goes into the gas. And so since gas is most of the mass, all but 1% of the mass, then supernovae will turn out to be important. So that's what young stars, especially massive stars, produce. And then this brings up the question of, well, that's the production rate, but of course it depends on, in the economic analogy, you know, how what your capital is, what is the star formation rate? How many young stars do you have producing this stuff? And that depends on the star formation rate. So we have to then think about what is actually setting the star formation rate. And that has to be determined by how much there is of the interstellar gas and what the state is of that interstellar gas. Okay, so as I mentioned before, the total amount of interstellar gas in the Milky Way, there's about 10 to the 10 solar masses total in gas. And most of that is atomic, about 10% of that is molecular. And the fraction of gas that's atomic versus molecular does depend on where you are in the galaxy. So the inner part of the galaxy is mostly molecular, whereas the outer part is mostly atomic. So this gas is, if you will, that's the raw material for star formation, and that's the raw material for the production of energy in this galaxy.
May I ask why those numbers are in that order? Because the radiation field is what's driving the breakdown of hydrogen to make atomic gas. Why is it so preponderant away from where the stars are distributed? Is that what you said, right? Atomic mostly on the outside, side, molecular mostly on the inside.
Because of the density. So gas becomes molecular when it's shielded, and the column densities are higher in the inner part, so there's more shielding.
So it starts at an initial state that's atomic. And it just can't be combined because of the low.
Because of the high column density. So yeah, it starts even ionized, and then it accretes into the galaxy, and it recombines and becomes atomic. So the stars are these young stars are the most active part, and the ISM is not only the production, but it's also the most reactive part of the galaxy because it's the one that can absorb and do something with the energy that it is given. And so that's why we're interested, when we talk about feedback, this is really what we're interested in. And we're interested in this because the energy that the stars produce can go back into the raw materials that made the stars themselves. And so there's this potential for a feedback loop upstream to affect what happens in some self-consistent way. Yep.
Could you explain the units? Like for radiation, the units are times second to the minus one, but L star seems to be just the energy unit.
Yes. So I just wrote these two things in. So this is.
There's a dot on top of that M.
This is just luminosity in Earth per second. This is mass in grams, and this is whatever units you like, because this has units of energy per time, and this is units of energy per time.
Oh, I see that.
Yeah, so you can use whatever, you can use better units than CGS, which is what astronomers in thinking do. So.
Sorry, I just missed that.
Sorry, I'll make this stop.
Yeah. And what is little M star?
What is?
Little M star.
Little M star.
To the right.
This one?
No. Oh, yeah. Ah.
So that's the total stellar mass that you make in order to make one supernova. Of course, it's mostly in the lower mass stars. Mm-hmm. Only of order 10 solar masses is in the actual star that explodes. Most of it is in the lower mass stars. But that's how much mass you put into star formation before you get one supernova out.
Thank you.
Okay, good, thanks. All right, so what sets the star formation rate? Well, we can go to this disk picture. So here's the galaxy. Here's the bulge in the middle. And I'm interested in, say, some patch out here in the disk. And we'll look at this patch of the disk, which you could look at either, you know, face on, it looks like the blackboard, edge on, it looks like a thin layer. So from dimensional analysis, you might say that the star formation rate is the amount of gas per unit area divided by some time scale. So what time scale might you use? Well, just from dimensional analysis, you might choose a time scale which is something like 1 over the square root of g rho. Which rho would you use? Well, if you used the density of the gas itself, that would be one choice, is the density of the gas itself, then you're kind of talking about free fall. But actually, if you look at a location, for example, in the solar neighborhood or at the solar circle more generally, the most important density is the largest part of the density is the density of the stellar disk. So even though, you know, the gas layer is thinner, but the total mass in stars per unit volume is actually higher. And the number for this is about 70 million years for stars. And if you use the gas, it's about 100 million years. And that's in the solar neighborhood. Okay, so if you tried to do this and used that as a gravitational time scale, you would be off by about 2 orders of magnitude.
Which way?
So it would be too high. So the star formation rate would be 2 orders of magnitude too high. So it's definitely not this. But if you did this, you would actually find scalings that are reasonable. So if you looked in different parts of a galaxy where the, you know, where the density in stars and the density of and the density of gas are variable, you would find reasonable scalings. It's just that you're off by 2 orders of magnitude. So there's something in this. It's just not, you know, there's something that is not quite right about just using that dynamical time. And that has led to the statement that star formation is inefficient because only of order 1% of the gas is turned into stars per dynamical time. But what I'll be arguing is that that's not really the proper point of comparison, and it's not really inefficient star formation, it's just you're looking at the wrong ratio. So to kind of understand that, see why that is, let's pause for a second and think about what a star does. So if you ask for a star, what is the corresponding time? It's about 3,000 seconds. So a star does not collapse in 3,000 seconds. And if you ask what determines the energy output rate of a star, it's not the dynamical time, but it's the diffusion time. Magnetic. So you have...
You're referring to magnetic diffusion.
No. So it's the energy diffusion. So radiation is diffusing out of a star. And that's really what determines the luminosity. It has a certain amount of, it has an energy content, which is basically set by dynamical equilibrium. And then that radiation is diffusing out or convecting out, depending on the kind of star. And that diffusion time in a star like the Sun is about 2,000 years. So that's what determines the rate of energy production in a star. And similarly, there's no, you know, why should we have privileged this just because it comes directly out of dimensional analysis when we think about star formation? So let's do something else, which is basically what you do when you think about stars, which is you think about, you know, what do you need for equilibrium? And for equilibrium, the basic things that you have to think of are energy conservation and momentum conservation. So that's what we can do when we think about the ISM. So let's now think about conservation laws.
And physics on Pisces?
Sorry?
Don't you need nuclear physics?
In a sense you do. So in a star you need, you know, you need the nuclear physics, but it actually has to make that energy because, you know, if it doesn't keep up, then you're kind of stuck. So it will readjust internally until it has to put in the amount of energy you need to make up for the diffusion out. And you know, the other parts that you put in nuclear physics are that basically determines the temperature. So you have to arrive at a size of star such that the dynamical temperature is 10 million years and fusion works. And that's what sets the sizes of stars and then therefore their density and therefore the diffusion time. So that's stellar structure. And the ISM is actually simpler. I hope I'll be able to explain why in not too long. Okay, so let's think about the energy. So the cooling rate, so this is energy balance. So the cooling rate is, we can generally write as n squared times some function of temperature. That's per unit volume. And we're balancing this against a heating rate per unit volume. So conveniently, the density, we can just remove one factor of the density here. We can put a temperature here. And so this is basically just pressure. And it turns out that because of the details of the atomic cooling, there are preferred temperatures in the interstellar medium. One preferred temperature is around 100 degrees. Another preferred temperature is around 10,000 degrees. This varies a little bit depending on whether it's neutral or ionized. But you can just think of this as being something, there is some kind of preferred temperature. So we're really talking about the pressure being determined by the heating rate. And this heating rate is proportional to the radiation field because the radiation is actually doing most of the heating. And that radiation field is proportional to the star formation rate. So this tells us that from energy balance, we expect that the thermal pressure should be proportional to the surface density of star formation. So that's energy balance. And so that means if we knew what the thermal pressure was, then we could go ahead and say, okay, I can now tell you what the star formation rate is. But we don't necessarily immediately know what the thermal pressure is because that depends on density and you need something else to know what the density is. And the other thing is you need to worry about dynamical equilibrium, that is the momentum equation. So let's think about the momentum equation. Actually, before I get to the momentum equation, I should talk about the other important form of energy balance, which is turbulence. And that is that the driving rate of turbulence, which is again going to be proportional to the star formation rate per unit volume, we'll divide by h. That is proportional to, so that's the gains, and then the losses are proportional to, well, it's basically the density times the velocity dispersion cubed over h. So this is turbulent driving. And dissipation.
That's H.
H is the thickness of the disk. So that's 2H. And that means that so this is relevant because the density is related to the surface density by H. Okay, so turbulent driving balances turbulent dissipation. And again, this tells you that the pressure will be related to the star formation rate. So now this is turbulent pressure. It is proportional to the surface density of star formation. Okay, so that's what we get from energy balance. And then we can similarly look at the momentum equation. So for the momentum equation, so gradient of P is rho times g. Integrate this from the midplane outward, and that tells you that the difference in pressure is basically the weight of the overlying interstellar gas. So if you're sitting here at the midplane, there's some weight of gas which is sitting on top of you, and that determines the pressure. And generally, the pressure will, this will be dominated almost definitionally by the midplane pressure. So we can write the total midplane pressure is basically surface density of gas over 2 times the average vertical gravity. This is GC.
There might be a naive question here, yep. But you've got the gas exerting pressure. Why does the dark matter not exert pressure?
Well, the dark matter could contribute to G here. But in fact, the density is not large enough to make a significant contribution to G here. The, if you look at clusters, the dark matter is important in determining the pressure in clusters, because that's most of the mass. But within this thin disk, basically when it's cooled so much that it's a thin layer, the gravity is dominated by the baryons. Okay, good, thanks. So the midplane pressure, which will be generally a sum of the thermal and the turbulent, has to balance gravity. And that's then what sets the density. And so you might say, well, what about magnetic fields? What about cosmic rays? So what is observed is that the scale height of the magnetic field and cosmic rays is much larger than that of gas. So since we're taking delta P, those basically, the difference between the pressure at the top of the atmosphere and at the midplane doesn't really do much in terms of this equilibrium. Although they may be, especially the cosmic rays, may be important in the international economy of the galaxies. Okay, so this then gives us, so if we use this, and then we use the sum of the pressures, which is proportional to the star formation rate, this gives us, so we could actually write these as the thermal pressure is some eta times the star formation rate. And similarly, the turbulent pressure is some other eta times the star formation rate. And if we take the sum of these and we equate it to this weight of the ISM, that gives us, see, I don't want to be at the very end of the board. Put it back here. The star formation rate, which is Gz over this total eta. So if you want to know the star formation rate, you just have to know the weight of the ISM, and you have to have properly calibrated those etas. And that tells you the star formation rate. So what about those etas? Let's see. So from doing heating and cooling balance, basically there's going to be some heating coefficient and some cooling rate coefficient, and you can get eta from that. And if you use the most convenient units, of course, that gives you about 1. But this turns out to be smaller than the one from turbulence. So let me tell you about the one from turbulence, which is actually more important. So what would you expect for the turbulent pressure? Or another way of thinking of this is, again, balancing turbulent driving and dissipation. This, from dimensional analysis, is a momentum per unit time per unit area. So if you think about some momentum input, stars generally form near the midplane of the disk. You divide this in half, and you ask, how much momentum per unit time are you sending into the upper half or the lower half? That is 1/4 of the momentum that you got per high mass star. And the number of high mass stars per unit time, per unit area, is this. So that's what you expect the turbulent pressure to be, or the kinetic pressure to be. And that gives you an eta of about 4 in the most convenient units. So then what about the gravity?
Is it the same M star is for the supernova?
So M star is the total mass in stars per supernova. Yep.
Is it just a unit, or this equation is somehow related to supernova?
So this equation, or the M star?
This
no, this is a, this depends on your mass function. So the mass function looks something like this, and the supernovae are above there, and you have to integrate under the whole mass function to get the total mass in stars per supernovae. So that's where the 100 solar masses comes in. And then this I haven't talked about yet, which is where that number comes, what is the momentum per supernova or per high mass star. So I'll talk about that next. Okay, so the, actually, I'll talk about that almost next. Let me just finish by saying a little bit about the gravity term, which is appearing here. So this, the gravity term, which is appearing here, depends on, again, whether you're in the stellar-dominated versus the gas-dominated potential case. So you can write this in two different ways. You can write it as so if the gas dominates the gravity, or you could write it as if the stars dominate the gravity, where that is the velocity dispersion in the gas. Okay, so, but the thing that's still missing is this P star, which appears either way. And we then have to think about what is actually giving us the momentum that's being fed back into the disk. So the so let's go back and look at this, these different sources that I outlined before for energy. And we can think about the same thing for momentum. So that was the energy per unit time. And if you want momentum, you just take this and you divide by c. That's pretty easy. So the momentum per time is just this divided by c, or per unit mass is that divided by c. And so that gives us then a momentum per mass in a steady state, which would be E star times C, which is 180 kilometers a second. So that's, if you have radiation that's photons that are absorbed once and then they're gone, that's what you get. You can make this larger by considering if you're opaque to IR, which happens only at very high surface density, then you can reuse those photons. And you can get another factor, which would basically increase this by 1 plus tau. So I can write times 1 plus tau IR, where tau IR I can write like this. And that's kappa in grams centimeter squared. So this is pretty small unless you're in a very extreme environment. You can get up to maybe about 10 in the most extreme, what are called ultra-luminous infrared galaxies. But surface density in, say, the solar neighborhood is about 10. So that's certainly not opaque to IR. And you can go, fairly far in. An individual molecular cloud is about 100, so again, that's not optically thick. And kappa is up to about, maybe about 5. Okay, so radiation can be interesting and important in the most extreme environments, but as I'll show, this is actually smaller than you get from supernovae. How long is my talk?
You've got 10 minutes.
Okay, good. So I'll be able to get through the supernovae. Okay, so the radiation field may be quite important for individual, the radiation momentum may be quite important for individual clouds. And one of the reasons for that is that they, you know, supernovae have a time delay. So before you ever get to the supernovae, they may be destroyed by either this or by what happens as a result of ionizing radiation. The ionizing radiation produces a very overpressured ionized bubble, which expands outward. That expanding H2 region can help and may, in many cases, destroy the cloud. And a lot of what people have been working on in our program is to assess this and to assess the similar thing for the that the ionizing radiation does. And a number of people, I don't know if they're, everyone's here, but a number of people have been working on this using numerical simulations. And it's important to really be able to characterize this. Okay, so now let's consider what a supernova does. So if you have a supernova, it injects this 10 to the 51 ergs. And the supernova ejecta are of order 10 solar masses. So the total momentum is about, the initial momentum is about 3 times 10 to the 4 solar masses, kilometers a second. However, this is when it's ejected at 1,000 kilometers a second, drives a shock into the surrounding medium, and then there's a reverse shock that goes back into the ejecta, so you get this hot bubble, this blast wave, which is expanding. And there's a well-known solution for the first part of that evolution, which is the Sedov-Taylor solution. And that solution, the self-similar solution, basically energy is conserved. This is Sedov. So R over T squared, R cubed rho is a constant. That's the 10 to the 51. And so that gives R goes as T to the 2/5. And that lasts until the leading shock becomes radiative. And the leading shock becomes radiative when the shock speed is about 200 kilometers a second. And when the leading shock is about 200 kilometers a second, it becomes radiative, and basically after that time, it's kind of coasting. And so if you want to know how much momentum did you get out of it, you take the 10 to the 51 ergs, you divide by this shock speed, and that gives the momentum that you've gotten out of this supernova at the radiative stage. And that is the momentum at the radiative stage is about 3 times 10 to the 5 solar masses kilometers a second. And it turns out that this is pretty insensitive to the ambient conditions. This is something that Chenggu will talk about in detail later this week, but based on numerical simulations. And that you can also kind of get out of the classical spherical solution as well, that it's insensitive to the ambient conditions, because it's basically, you know, there's a certain temperature when the shock becomes radiative. And so notice that this is a bigger number. Well, first of all, it's an order of magnitude larger than that, and it is also an order of magnitude larger than this, unless you're under very optically thick conditions, to even to IR radiation. So we can take this, and that, if we treat that as the dominant momentum, we can plug in here, and that then gives us the star formation rate. And so let's take the case of the, and I should say that here it says a power law which varies as the square of the gas surface density at high surface densities, which is when the gas dominates. And it depends on the gas as well as the stars under less extreme conditions, as would apply in the solar neighborhood, for example. So let me tell you, let's put in the numbers for the solar neighborhood. For the solar neighborhood, rho star is 0.05 solar masses per cubic parsec. That's this. The velocity dispersion is about 10 kilometers a second. Use this number for the momentum for high mass star. M star was over there. And this works out to, we'll do solar neighborhood. Is works out to give a star formation rate, which is 3 × 10⁻⁹ solar masses per square parsec per year. And that is indeed the observed star formation rate in the solar neighborhood. And if you go back and ask what the corresponding timescale is, the corresponding timescale which we talk about as the depletion time, which is the gas surface density over the star formation rate. That is 3 GeV. And that can be compared to what I just from dimensional analysis put in at the beginning, was said, well, what's the gravitational time scale? This is a factor of 40, that was that two orders of magnitude, larger than this naive dynamical time that you would imagine if you were just doing dimensional analysis. So this is also dimensional analysis, but the difference is that we're looking at the meaningful dimensional analysis. We're looking at not just saying that gas should be collapsing and end of story on one dynamical time, but we're actually looking at what is necessary to maintain an equilibrium because galaxies and their interstellar medium are in a kind of quasi-equilibrium state. And this so you can make this comparison for galaxies, and it actually does quite well in the outer part of galaxies. This does well in the inner part of galaxies. But there's, so that all looks pretty good. There's some kind of in-between state, though, which is where galaxies are mostly molecular, but instead of being in this kind of, you know, quasi, it's not uniform, it's never uniform, but instead of being in a layer like this, which is an equilibrium by itself, there are parts of galaxies where most of the gas is in molecular clouds which are individually gravitationally bound. And when you have individually gravitationally bound clouds, you can't really do this operation of looking at the overall equilibrium. You have to think about what is the appropriate time-averaged equilibrium over a cloud's lifetime. And that's the other thing, or another thing that people have been very interested in this program and elsewhere, is basically doing, trying to understand that the appropriate way to think about clouds over their lifetimes, including the different forms of essentially momentum and energy input. So you still expect to have something, I'll write that now as cloud over star. So that's, you still expect to have something like momentum for time in has to balance the cloud mass times some appropriate average of the cloud velocity dispersion, but the devil is going to be in the details. And so this is something that essentially people are very interested in doing, where now this is going to have to include all of the different complications of what happens in an individual cloud, that is, the expanding H2 region, the radiation forces, and of course, the fact that the cloud may be still forming as it's dispersing. So that is, that's the very, you know, the very active research area now. And the final word I'll say is that you know, I haven't completely, I didn't say anything about it, but we also have international relations. And if you look at, if you kind of go back through and look at how much momentum are we, do we need to put in, if you look at how much is available, there's still enough to drive winds, but we want to understand in detail how much is going into driving into driving winds versus how much is going into the galaxy's own internal needs. Okay, I'll stop there.
Another example of international relations is ram pressure. I mean, if a galaxy is getting pushed, I assume that changes the momentum, or at least the pressure that the midpoint of the galaxy experiences, or does it?
So you mean pushed by being in a cluster environment?
Yeah, if you take a disk that's happy regulating its dark emission, but then you experience ram pressure.
You mean from the outside?
From the external.
So if it's moving, yeah. So I think that in part what that does is, you know, there's some radius within which that is not important, and then that's what you have left of a galaxy in some very broad sense. Of course, since it's from one side, you know, you are not going to have a disk there unless it's not significant.
Okay, so just if you put this number that you derived,
yes.
Do you get exactly more or less the number of supernova which we actually have in our galaxy?
Yeah.
Do you get it right?
Yes, yes.
So how many supernova during the lifetime of our galaxy have been produced? Total.
Well, I'd have to work it out. I can't tell you. But it's about one, that you expect about one every 50 years in our galaxy.
Supernova go off one at a time, so these are discrete events. Mm-hmm. And if we take a small volume, then there might be no supernova explosions during the collapse time, and this volume should collapse.
Right.
How big is that volume?
Right, so that is what is happening with making individual clouds. So if you ask what is the balance of the ISM in kind of diffuse gas versus what we would call gravitationally bound clouds, when this process of, you know, not having the timescale being too long compared to the timescale for collapse, these massive clouds are what happens in kind of ambient environment of a solar neighborhood, for example. It's about one supernova every million years in a box which is equal to two scale heights on a side. So since the dynamical time is basically the gas disk has arranged itself so that dynamical time is consistent with the supernova rate. But what can happen is if the supernovae, you know, in a sense can't keep up, then you end up having this condensate of, you know, gas spending more of its time in this dense state where it's not supernovae, but it is other things that are essentially allowing those to percolate along until those clouds are destroyed. So that's why the timescale, if you look at molecular gas by itself, it has a timescale which is this corresponding depletion time, which is about 2 giga years, kind of. And you can look in different parts of a galaxy which are molecular, at the molecular component, and they typically always have about the same time scale. So it means it's not sensitive to the environment, it's just that's something about how clouds evolve over time under their own internal economies.
Jim? What about AGM? When do they modify this little picture?
So I think they modify the international picture because they're basically affecting
the... Translate the question.
So an AGN is an active galactic nucleus, and the nucleus part is, you know, where it is in a galaxy. So it can affect the maybe the inner kiloparsec. But what it does is it puts a lot of energy into the halo. And one of the things that may do is it may prevent gas from actually cooling and falling into the galaxy. And so that in a sense is, you know, I've said I have a certain amount of mass that I have to work with. And given that on a short time scale, how do we form stars within the galaxy versus, for example, how does this gas accrete inward to, you know, live somewhere else and in particular to feed the AGN? So you have to kind of know what's happening within the galaxy to determine what might be feeding the AGN and then what feeds back to the larger scale halo.
Yeah.
We're talking about sort of a bookkeeping analysis.
Correct.
Coming in.
Economics is a fancy word for bookkeeping.
Checking the books. But I got the impression from what you're saying is that everything looks okay. You're not finding any evidence of somebody embezzling something.
Cosmic corruption.
Yes, there's.
Yeah, and so. The picture fits together.
So the picture fits together on a kind of a gross level. But what we would like to understand more now, I think, is the details of what's happening in clouds where we don't really have a good picture. For example, why is the typical surface density of a cloud such and such? How does that vary with the ambient conditions? You know, when you go to more extreme environments, how important does radiation pressure become? So there are a lot more, you know, there's kind of broad brush. It looks. That's why we have this program, because we think that feedback actually answers a lot of questions. But now we want to understand in greater detail how it does that.
Thank you.